Translation: Alas, has Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu incarnated to deliver all kinds of sinners with the exception of a king named Maharaj Pratapuradra? Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission is thus described by Narottam Das Thakur: Patita pavana hetu tava avatar, mosama patita prabhu na paibe ara. If Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu descended to reclaim sinners, then one who is the most sinful and low-born is the first candidate for the Lord's consideration. Maharaj Pratapuradra considered himself a most fallen soul because he had to deal with material things constantly and enjoy material profits. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's business was the deliverance of the most fallen. How then could he reject the king? The more fallen a person is, the more he has the right to be delivered by the Lord, provided, of course, he surrenders unto the Lord. Maharaj Pratapuradra was a fully surrendered soul. Therefore, the Lord could not refuse him on the grounds that he was a worldly pounds shillings man. Let's do Mangalarchanam, and then we'll do the verses that precede this. Om Agyante Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Atapada Kamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padhan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adaita Gadadhar Shrivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So let's scroll back to verse 38 and let's read the translations from there to 46. Sri Ramananda Rai continued, "What shall I do? My mind has brought me here. I could not consider going first to Lord Jagannath's temple." Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu advised, "Immediately go to Lord Jagannath's temple to see the Lord, then go home and meet your family members." Having received Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's permission, Ramananda Rai hastily went to the temple of Lord Jagannath. Who can understand the devotional service of Ramananda Rai? When King Pratapuradra returned to Jagannath Puri, he called for Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. When the Bhattacharya went to see the king offered him respects and made the following inquiries. The king asked, "Have you submitted my petition to the Lord?" Sarvabhauma replied, "Yes, with much endeavor, I have tried my best. Yet, despite my great endeavor, the Lord would not agree to see a king. Indeed, he said that if he were asked again, he would quit Jagannath Puri and go elsewhere." Hearing this, the king became very unhappy and greatly lamenting, began to speak as follows. The king said, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has descended just to deliver all kinds of sinful, low-born persons. Consequently, he has delivered sinners like Jagai and Madai. Alas, has Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu incarnated to deliver all kinds of sinners with the exception of a king named Maharaj Prataparudra? I'm going to repeat the purport just because it's so short. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission is thus described by Narottam Das Thakur, Patita Pavana Hetu Tava Avatar, Mosama Patita Prabhu Napaibe Ar. If Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu descended to reclaim sinners, then one who is the most sinful and low-born is the first candidate for the Lord's consideration. Maharaj Prataparudra considered himself a most fallen soul because he had to deal with material things constantly and enjoy material profits. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's business was the deliverance of the most fallen. How then could he reject the king? The more fallen a person is, the more he has the right to be delivered by the Lord, provided, of course, he surrenders unto the Lord. Maharaj Prataparudra was a fully surrendered soul. Therefore, the Lord could not refuse him on the grounds that he was a worldly pound shilling man. These conversations between the Lord and his intimate devotees, and between the devotees themselves, especially the conversations we hear in particular in the Charitamrita, they are nectarian, they're beautiful, they're heartfelt, and they're moving. But they can also be very disturbing to the human mind. One may read this, here's this king, he's lamenting. He feels excluded, right? He feels fallen. If we look at these three qualities or emotional states, if we were to assess them based on what is considered good psychological health, one would deem these to be undesirable states to be in, right? One deems it undesirable to be lamenting, to feel excluded, to feel fallen. And whereas Maharaj Prataparudra is kind of celebrating this undeserved deservedness, right? This is Lord Chaitanya has come to rescue and to deliver and to embrace those who are most fallen, that your disqualification is your qualification. You are so much in need of my association, I'm just going to give it to you freely. However, when we hear these words, if we just see them through the lens of human nature, they seem like almost like the mindset of somebody who has low self-esteem, somebody who's suffering, somebody who's struggling, somebody who doesn't have self-love, somebody who doesn't have self-respect. Right? We look at digital media, social media, books that are coming out, the writings, you know, of popular authors, they're very much rooted in strengthening our sense of identity. Excuse me. And we look at Maharaj Prataparudra, for a king who is of his stature, for him to have this thinking seems even more undesirable. Now, what do you have to feel fallen about? What do you have to feel excluded for? You know, what do you have to lament? You have everything. But, and why is it undesirable? Because in our human living, in our day-to-day life, these three states, feeling excluded, feeling fallen, lamented, we're not particularly productive in that state of mind, right? So much of our life day-to-day is based on how much can I produce? How much can I make? How much can I do? Yes? And who am I? So in terms of human psychology, yes, they're undesirable. But in terms of divine thought, spiritual psychology, the mindset of a Vaishnava, these are extremely desirable. When we look at what is deemed to be healthy human psychology, it can seem very much in conflict with devotional thinking, okay, devotional dialogue, devotional internal dialogue. And, you know, there's a good reason for that, because they're actually designed for different things. Human psychology is actually designed very perfectly by material nature, by the Lord, in order to protect the transient eye, the false I. It's designed for that. Our mind is designed in such a way, when we separate from Krishna, when we say, okay, I want to turn away from who I actually am, I want to turn away from who I'm eternally connected to, and I'm going to turn away from that relationship and forget it. What we're basically saying is, I need to adopt an identity which is able to live in that kind of mindset. So the human psychology, regardless of Varna and Ashram, when we're engaging with our whatever personality type mindset we have in this world, it is designed, the mind is designed, and that thinking and behavior is designed to protect the transient I as much as possible. And because the transient I is constantly under threat. Why is it constantly under threat? Because everything's always changing. So our who am I in this world also then has to keep changing, right? Because who am I in any situation, even our transcendental psychology, even in our transcendental identity, our identity is always in relationship to something or someone, isn't it? Right? We are someone's relative. We are someone's friend. We are someone's, we have a function in a particular workplace or within the household, right? Or in a group setting or in a volunteering club or in a social club. We have some purpose, right? Our identity is formed based on our form, on the way we behave, the way we think. But it's always having to change. The minute we think, oh, I'm my authentic self, we can no longer be that authentic self because the circumstances have changed. And because the circumstances have changed, that authentic self, which was so authentic last year, now feels inauthentic, right? So with this human, our human sense of I is always under threat. So that mind, that human mind, is designed in such a way, in such a robust way, that, okay, I'm here to protect your transient I. So whenever your transient I is under threat, I will do whatever I can to navigate things so we can quickly find a way to feel comfortable. Okay? So because of this feeling of constantly being under threat, this constant change under the influence of the conditioned mind is, accompanied by these six, what we call enemies. They're friends to the conditioned mind, but they're enemies to the divine psychology. You know, fear, envy, anger, lust, madness, and illusion. Okay, these six, you know, group of friends. They hang out. They're there as allies to help the human psychology protect the transient ego. And what happens when your transient sense of self is constantly under threat? What does the human psychology do? It starts to divide, doesn't it? It starts to divide. We create so many divisions. Why do we make so many divisions? They're like a barrier, right? We put boundaries up, okay? We put boundaries up, we create spaces, we create divisions in society. We create political divisions, gender divisions, race divisions, varna divisions, ashram divisions. They can also become caught up in the false ego and not be, you know, transcended. Some people find it very difficult to dovetail those things. We make divisions in our own families, and we even make divisions in our own self. Okay, we make divisions, we make little compartments in our own mind to make life digestible, right? We also make divisions within ourselves, and we will hide and repress things that we don't want to see. So this human psychology is set up very much in a way to protect the false ego. But we look at the opposite, our real ego, our real psychology, the psychology of what Prabhupada actually, Sukadeva Goswami refers to in the second canto as the super self, okay? He talks about the super self, the Atma, that this super self, and Prabhupada refers to that the super self has a supra consciousness and a supra mind. So super self is a supra mind with a supra consciousness, okay? So above and beyond and different to human psychology. This spiritual psychology also is designed to protect, but protect the Shraddha Gokul Nanda Ki Jai, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai, Gornitai Ki Jai. So our transcendental or psychology of our supramind and superconsciousness is there to protect the super self, the identity of our spiritual self. And the identity of our spiritual self is completely in relationship with Krishna. So anything that interferes or threatens our relationship with Krishna, immediately our supramind and supraconsciousness deals with it. So Maharaj Pratapa Rudra, you know, in this mood of he's fully surrendered, Prabhupada is explaining. So he's not thinking we're like an, you know, ordinary person whose only identity that's revealed to him is of as a king. He is situated in his identity in relationship with the Lord. This is the Supreme Personality of Godhead he's talking about. So yes, he is lamenting because he's lamenting everything that gets in the way between him and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Okay, this is why he's lamenting his kingliness, because right now, based on what Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is telling him, his kingly status, his wealth, his opulence is standing between him and darshan of the Lord. See, this, our divine way of thinking, our divine way of feeling, our divine way of conducting ourselves, and actually when I say divine, I mean our natural way of conducting ourselves and thinking, is in such opposition to human psychology, okay, that when we really get into the nitty-gritty of being the servant of the servant, of becoming offenseless and becoming unoffendable, it actually requires us to really change our thinking and change the way we see the importance of who we are in this world. Look, I'm all for, especially given that the work that I do, I think a healthy psychology, a healthy sense of self in this world actually makes spiritual life easier. It does it far easier to detach from something and someone you have a healthy relationship with, even the transient ego, where it's skewed, where it's kind of avoidant or anxious, what we call in, you know, Shastra, Bhogatyaga. One minute you really want it, next minute you want to renounce it, right? This is anxious, avoidant attachment. When we have that relationship with anything or anyone, including our human ego, then it makes it very difficult to detach and form an attachment anywhere else. But when we have a secure attachment, a mature value for everything that Krishna has given us, even those things which are designed to keep us here, when we have a value for those things in the context that if I understand this, I can also unravel myself from it, then it actually becomes easier to experience it and also detach from it and then attach to Krishna. So, but when we look at divine psychology, it's completely different. It's not there to protect this self. In fact, the divine psychology can't wait to dissolve this self and embrace, who am I? Who am I to Krishna? Who am I to Krishna? And who is he to me? And I'm willing to do whatever it takes to make myself available to be used in his service, to be used in the service of his associates. And I take pleasure in this. There is a pleasure in that. It is rooted in security. When we are, because our human sense of self is always under threat, it's fragile, right? It's fragile. It's constantly looking to be tethered somewhere. It needs an anchor. Okay, I'm going to secure myself in this identity. Now I'm going to secure myself in this identity or this object or this wealth or this persona or this stage of life. I'm secure here now. Don't move me, you know? Whereas our actual natural sense of self is very fluid, very secure. It's rooted in this unshakable trust that Krishna's all mine and I'm all his. He's always present. He's always looking out for me. And in that security, in that trust, it is very easy to surrender. Right? We surrender not out of fear. We don't surrender out of fear. We actually surrender out of love. It is natural. It is organic. It doesn't require thinking. It just happens. When you are, anybody ever played that trust game? I think most people have. Your friend stands behind you and you're supposed to just, you know, let gravity take its course, let go and fall backwards. And you trust that your friend's going to catch you. You know, it's often a good assessment of your relationship with your friend. Right? Or even of how much you trust your body and the way it's going to fall, that actually will my friend catch me? Right? And this is the thing, this our natural self is actually very loved, very secure. Doesn't really feel rejected in the ordinary sense. Even the feeling fallen, these words that Maharaj Prataparudra, he's making contradictory statements in the sense that he's saying he's undeservedly deserving. Actually, I'm exactly the kind of person that Krishna's looking to save. So why? Why is he excluding me? And even Prabhupada, at the end of the purport, he says, yeah, so, you know, Lord Chaitanya had no reason to really, you know, not see him or not accept him just because he's a pounds and shillings man. Prabhupada's at the end of his purport actually also agreeing, yes, let's challenge Lord Chaitanya on this. What is going on? And we'll come back to this in a few moments. I want to just discuss a little bit more about this, you know, the way our human mind works. You know, our mind, really, if we look at it from a holistic and Shastric perspective, the mind is many things, and one of the things the mind is a bridge. It is a bridge between our external and transient identity and our natural sense of who we are, right? We see the natural sense of who we are is illuminating. It illuminates with love, with knowledge, with security. Even before you know who you are, what your service is, who Krishna is, just that sense of security that I am connected. It's illuminating. It gives the mind strength, doesn't it? Don't you feel an empowerment when you just immediately hear that? Oh, just even that verse where Krishna tells Arjuna that, you know, you're amazing. The soul is amazing. You have no beginning, no end. You cannot be burned. You cannot be dried. You cannot be wet. Okay, never was there a time that you did not exist. Never will there be a time when you cease to exist. But when you hear that, you remember, think about the first time you read or heard that. How wonderful that feels. There's no one here who is going to write a book telling you you're going to live forever. Okay, most people who are writing books about, okay, we're mortal. Let's try and make a good, you know, good deal out of this bad bargain that we've got. And yeah, wonderful. Anybody who's helping us to value life, to do something better, we should appreciate them, okay? But these, just even that, one doesn't even have to wait until one's fully realized to feel the pleasure, the satisfaction, the security that comes from our natural sense of who we are. But you look at the other side of the bridge, okay, that's outward looking, right? It is, you have these, that's constantly being threatened. So the mind is knotted up, you know, it's like a forest. A forest that has all these creepers and trees and plants made up of these six enemies. Okay, literally are crossing over each other, intertwined, working together, and it feels clogged up, right? It feels confused. It's either blocked or split into many different directions, right? If you've ever tried just sitting with your mind, you will see the things that come up for you will not, you know, there'll be things there that are not pleasant. You know, when we chant japa, maybe some of you also practice some breath meditation or quiet meditation before you go into japa, it can be unnerving for some people, because it's unnerving for most people, because it brings up thoughts and feelings which are functions of the mind, and maybe even desires and aversions that we may push aside by our activity, right? We keep ourselves busy. I keep ourselves busy, distracting ourselves often as well in terms of what's going on for ourselves. So it's like this side of the bridge is like this knotted up forest. And we want to get from one side of the bridge, the outward facing, to the more inner facing, right? How do you cut through that forest? How do we cut through this forest and get to the other side of the bridge, that side which is illuminated? And actually, as we cut through the forest, that illumination, it actually floods the entire mind. Then the human psychology is also flooded with our natural way of thinking. So we look at, for example, you know, this mood of wanting to serve. In this mood, we don't need to create divisions. In that mood, the differences unite us, right? In that mood, the variety is to be celebrated. When we are threatened, differences divide us. When we feel threatened, differences look scary, don't they? When we feel threatened, because we feel like that difference is taking something away from me. But when we have our relationship with Krishna, the more and more secure it gets, the more real it gets, the more manifest it becomes, then our natural, our psychology of our supramind and our superconsciousness, it starts to flood the entire mind. So really, our process of Krishna consciousness, a big part of it is transformation of what our mind does. Yes, this material mind is eventually dissolved, so is the entire subtle body. It is dissolved, but in the process of our bhakti, there is definitely a transformation that takes place. So when we read these conflicting statements that seem to be like, now, as a Vaishnava who's trying to practice self-love and self-respect in this world and trying to have a healthy ego so that I can ultimately have, you know, be completely surrendered to Krishna, do my services externally and internally wonderfully. How can I be that if I have to see myself as fallen and lamenting about being fallen and realize that maybe I'm excluded because maybe I'm not fallen enough or maybe I'm too fallen, right? So our mind kind of constantly flits looking for an excuse. Look, there's a lot of reasons why, you know, Krishna's not interested in you, right? The mind is constantly giving us reason. This is the thing. Maharaj Pratapurudra, his lamentation, I mean, you can see a distinct difference here between low self-esteem and this divine psychology of feeling undeservedly deserving. It's in his mind, he's undeservedly deserving means that, yes, he recognizes his deficits, but those deficits are deficits in relationship to everything the Lord gives him. In fact, he's so grateful. He knows, my gosh, there is nothing I can ever do to reciprocate. There is nothing I can ever be that will fully satisfy the Lord because he's actually already fully satisfied. And yet, he is interested in me. So that discrepancy is not rooted in, oh, poor me, I don't have enough. It's rooted in, I'm grateful. And that's why humility is rooted in gratitude. Right? You see this this eagerness that Maharaj Pratapurudra has comes from his humility, comes from the fact that he actually values the Lord has taken the time, made a choice to come at a time when people are not interested in him to make himself available. Would you do that? Don't we walk around usually saying, oh, I go where I'm valued. I want to go where I'm loved. I want to serve where I'm cared for. And Krishna's coming. I want to go where people don't want to know me. Okay, they've forgotten me. They're not interested. Okay, they're doing everything that I don't want them to do. And I'm going to love them freely. And I'm going to love them so freely, they're not going to help but fall back in love with me. That's essentially what he's doing. This is Lord Chaitanya's mission. To not kill the Jagai and Madai within us, not kill the demons within us with weapons, but to transform with love. Right? We even see this in human relationships where somebody has a relative, a child, a loved one who's really behaving in a way which is self-sabotaging, damaging, destructive to themselves, destructive to other people. And they find that the most powerful thing to transform that person is to love them. Not reprimand them, not point out constantly their faults. Now, can you imagine if Lord Chaitanya came here with a long list of the faults of the, you know, human beings of Kali Yuga? We'd all be like, okay, well, you know, I don't think I'm going to take to this process because you've basically just called me a failure and told me that there's no reason for my existence, that I'm completely useless to you. But no, he hasn't done that at all. What he said is, I know you're not interested in me and it's not your fault. Don't worry. What can we do? It's the times that we're in. So here you go. Have the strongest antidote to get you back to your natural state. Because actually, you know something? I know something you don't know. You actually love me. And I'm going to remind you of that. If you call my name enough times, you will reawaken that love. So Maharaj Pratapurudra's surrender, his confidence in his lack of qualification being his qualification is because it's rooted in the gratitude that he experiences from actually being connected to the Lord. It's not rooted in this feeling of, I don't have enough, I'm not good enough, and you know, I'm so not good enough that it's more powerful than the Lord's love for me. You know, low self-esteem is like that. Low self-esteem tells us that our faults are more powerful than Krishna's love. I mean, that's a pretty arrogant place to be. That it's another way of saying I'm God, isn't it? That my faults are more powerful than anything else in this world. There's nothing else that can overpower my faults. There's a short pastime with Srila Prabhupada. One of his disciples describes, you know, he was, you know, answering, like Prabhupada was greeting him and he was just expressing how fallen he is. And Prabhupada says, you know, you're not the most anything. He said, I'm the most fallen, Srila Prabhupada. He goes, you're not the most anything. you know, this, we always want to be the most something, even if it's the most fallen. So this again, whereas as Vaishnavas, when we're seeing, okay, how do I integrate the human psychology with the divine psychology? It's not a matter of integration. It's a matter of transformation. And transformation, there's many ways we can see as beginning and progressing, okay? So the first thing that we all do that we when we first come into contact with spiritual knowledge, and particularly the knowledge of bhakti, is that we understand that our sense of who we are isn't always threatened, that the threat is an illusion. We're permanently loved, okay? We're eternally wise and we're blissfully connected. Right, this is the first thing, because immediately, just even with that small piece of factual information, okay, it's not yet a realization, it's factual information. When Krishna first presents it to Arjuna, it's a factual new piece of information that Arjuna is being given. Okay, we're given this factual piece of information, it already has a powerful impact in it's aligning. It's aligning the human psychology with our divine psychology. This is our process of transformation, is align, make it similar, right? Let's make the human psychology similar to our divine psychology. So this is the first thing. This is the very, very first thing. And then what do we start to do? We already are familiar with making our activities in alignment, right? We dovetail all of our activities in Krishna service. But then we also want to imbibe the mood, the thinking of our natural self, okay? Our natural self. Take, for example, it is natural. It is natural in our eternal self to constantly feel gratitude. This gratitude is a natural state of the supra consciousness. Okay? It is not something we learn. It is something we are. It is something we have. Okay, and as spiritual practitioners, we imbibe this. Okay, so that we imbibe this by getting the human psychology to practice it, because it aligns our human psychology with our natural psychology. Okay, remember, our motive is a big part of our Krishna consciousness. Oh, Hare Krishna Prabhu. A lot of people these days are practicing gratitude because of the dopamine and the serotonin hit. Okay, there's a lot of scientific research going into the biological and psychological value of positive psychology, but spiritual psychology. Okay, those attitudes that are considered valuable to flourishing spiritually. Yeah, they're normally the conversation topics for those who are monks, priests, spiritual practitioners, meditators. Okay, this the language of forgiveness, becoming unoffendable, becoming offenseless, being humble, being kind, tolerant. These are not usually, and they've become, thankfully, more in the fabric of modern psychology and modern medicine. Because why? The research is showing us that yes, it's really good for your brain to be like that. It translates as a dopamine hit or a serotonin hit, right? It makes you feel good. That is ultimately a material motive, right? On its own. But actually, if we understand actually as on a spiritual path, we want to embrace gratitude, imbibe gratitude, because it aligns then the human psychology with our natural state of self. That's a higher motive. Isn't it? It's a like, even if you look at the modes, with the modes, the same things are happening. It's just the motive is different, the purpose is different, right? The mode of ignorance is a different motive. The mode of passion, there's a different motive. With the mode of goodness, there's a different motive. And then with transcendental consciousness, there's a different motive still. Okay, which is why we end up with, you know, so many different types of devotional service. And in this sense, when we are taking, because we have got a culture more and more in our Vaishnava community to read outside of transcendental literature. You know, 25, 30 years ago, even 20 years ago and 15 years ago, the culture was to primarily read transcendental literature. Now the culture has shifted. We are reading transcendental literature sometimes. And most people actually, I meet many devotees I meet now, they're reading more outside books, self-help books. And part of the reason they're reading these things is because people struggle. People are really, really struggling. The world is in a difficult place, politically, financially, emotionally, socially. I mean, climate-wise, everything is crumbling, okay? And so people are experiencing this within their micro communities as well as on an expansive level. So people are looking for help with that, direct help, practical help. And I guess my caution with it is the practical help is helpful and can help us on our, in our spiritual journey. It can certainly clear the path. But the thing with association isn't just about understanding what I should do, but why I should do it. And one can very quickly adopt the motives of the author and the motives that are inherent within why the research has happened, who the research is targeted to, what's the ultimate goal of the research, right? You look at Bhagavatam. The entire Bhagavatam is spoken on one premise. Maharishi Parikshit's question, what is the best thing for all people to do at all times, and especially when they're approaching death? And actually, this is the first question that has to be answered, because in answering this question, one then naturally comes to questions of, well, then who am I? Who is Krishna? And who am I to Krishna, and who is he to me? Because the entire Srimad Bhagavatam is there to ascertain what the best thing to do is for all people at all times and how to do it. Because in a nutshell, his answer to, you know, if you distilled everything out of those 12 cantos, and you look at the one thing that Shukadev Goswami and Suta Goswami and all the other sages that they are quoting come back to time and time and time again, is surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, by chanting his holy name. Why do we keep coming back to the holy name? Because the holy name has the greatest potency to align and transform our human psychology to our natural psychology. You want to cut through a forest, you need a sharp blade. Now, anybody who does gardening here, you know that there are some weeds and some plants that grow that your little snipping scissors just aren't going to do much. Okay, you need big shears, and then you need something electrical. You know, it's the holy name is the most powerful, categorically, unanimously, because it's, you know, within it, or all of Krishna's opulences, including himself. Cut through the forest of these, you know, six enemies of the mind. Whatever your forest is made of, however it's manifested in this lifetime, can transform it very, very quickly. So whatever practices we do, whether they are born of outside literature or transcendental literature, absolutely has to be coupled with chanting. Prabhupada even says that our service, if we're not chanting, our service is simply work. Our service is simply work. And you know, there's this beautiful verse in the Antya Lila where Haridas Thakur is giving his instructions in the third chapter. And he talks about the power of the holy name. He describes it like the sunrise. The sunrise dissipates darkness even before you see the sunshine or even the sun. If anybody's ever seen a sunrise, hopefully everybody here has, you'll see that actually as dawn emerges, the sky becomes lighter, but you can't actually see the sunshine, can you? You can't see even the sun glow, but you see that the darkness is going. So please do not underestimate, and I'm telling you this from the profession that I come from. I deal with the mind and serious mental disorders all day, every day, okay? There is, and the various techniques we have, yes, psychological help, talking therapies, hypnotherapy, body work, therapeutic massage, art therapy, drama therapy, medication, all of those things are needed for many people to get their mind to a stable place. That's absolutely fine. But actually to transform the mind to a place where actually our natural self can come through, where we can move from chanting the holy name just in sound only to actually chanting in its pure state, to get to understanding who am I, who is Krishna, and who are we to each other. That really happens with the power of the holy name. Haridas Thakur explains how, you know, freedom from the reactions to sinful life, so bhakti, and or reactions to material activities, bhakti and mukti, liberation, They're just side effects. Actually, the primary purpose and function of the Holy Name is to give, bestow love of God. But the power of the Holy Name is so powerful that it is working on us even before we can chant properly. Okay? Even before it's fully emerged in our heart, in our mind, even before we even know how to express and embrace it properly, just like the sun. Just like the sun. It's like the vaccine, the antibiotic, and the nutritional drink all in one. Okay? It's everything. All right? And if somebody sold you that this particular medicine, you know, it will kill off everything you have, it will protect you from anything that attacks you, and it will help you go stronger. We'll all be like queuing up to buy it, right? And we've got that. We've got that in the Holy Name. I think we all too easily give up on the Holy Name. People give up on chanting, right? Because we don't understand this simple fact that actually the things that the Holy Name works on often aren't visible to us. Just like when you take an antibiotic, it is killing off bacteria that are not visible to you. The only thing that is visible to us when we have an infection is our symptom. Whether that's pus, whether that's swelling, whether that's pain, whatever it is that the infection has caused, it's the symptom we go to get cured. So a lot of people come to spiritual life to get their symptoms of the distress of material life cured because we're out of place here, right? So we go, you get given an antibiotic. People, when they give up the antibiotic prematurely because like, my pain's not gone yet, my swelling's not gone yet. But actually what the antibiotic's doing is it's destroying the bacteria at a level that you can't see bacteria. You need a microscope to see bacteria. All you can see is the effect of the bacteria. So the way the Holy Name's working is working on, our mind has all these layers, the conscious, the subconscious, the unconscious, carrying lifetime after lifetime of memories, even the memories of this lifetime that most of us don't remember. We've had so many millions of impressions since we came into this world. And the Holy Name's working on clearing all of that out, all of the things that make us insecure, all of the things that tether us here, all the things, the attachments, the aversions. It's literally dealing with our anarthas at a microscopic and atomic level. Okay, to a point where, yes, we may not feel symptomatic relief straight away, but keep going. Because we're not chanting really to make ourselves physiologically comfortable or, you know, psychologically comfortable, although it does have these benefits. All right, but because we are actually engaged in the business of actually, I want to restore my relationship with Krishna. So then we also leave the timing up to him. We're not approaching him saying, can you please remove my distress? Can you do this along the way? And can you do this along the way? And then they're just distractions. If we're finding ourselves doing that, we can check, you know, I'm getting caught up in my symptoms again. I'm taking the medicine. Let me keep taking the medicine rather than constantly looking for antidotes for my symptoms. So I want to just come back really to Maharaj Bratapurudra and his mood. Just coming back to this pastime. You know, the way he's inquiring from Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, he's expressing to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, he's using the medium of proving that I'm undeservingly deserving to really express his eagerness to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is his shiksha guru in this instance, right? His guru. Our whole process of devotional service is actually rooted in shiksha. The diksha guru is our shiksha guru before they become our diksha guru. And then we have so many other shiksha gurus. We are trained and transformed through instruction. Okay, so he's already surrendered and he's expressing his enthusiasm. He's expressing his eagerness. He's expressing his determination to his spiritual master. This eagerness, surrender, determination is attractive. It's attractive to the teacher. It's attractive to the spiritual master. And so Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, he then gives, and you'll see in the verses that ensue, you'll hear about them next week, the verses that ensue, he actually gives Maharaj Bratapurudra the thing that the spiritual master bestows upon the disciple, which is the most confidential knowledge, the secret of how to come close to the Lord. But Srila Prabhupada says that actually, you know, we chant, but the ability to chant purely is bestowed upon us by the mercy of the spiritual master, which is received by showing our endeavor, our sincerity, and our determination in our practice, in our sadhana, in our service. That never giving up no matter what, not letting our faults or our strengths get in the way. So Prabhupada says many times that actually the quickest way really to transform the mind is by the blessings of the spiritual master. Why? Because with the blessings of the spiritual master, the ability to chant properly awakens. And so Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, in the verses that ensue, what does he tell Maharaj Pratapurudra? You know what he tells him? How do you get close to the Lord? He says, okay, you know what? He's going to be dancing in front of the Rath cart. You should go there. That's how you'll meet him. He has given Maharaj Pratapurudra a very confidential piece of information. Don't you think? He's given him how to access the Lord directly, even though the Lord has actually said no. In fact, if you propose this again, I'm going to leave Jagannath Puri. It's okay. I'm going to, and this is the risk Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya has taken as the guru. I'm going to risk what he said to me and risk displeasing him to deliver and to help this one particular soul who's so surrendered, who's so eager, who's so determined to come close. I'm so pleased by it that I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to actually give him, you know, some roundabout way to actually connect with the Lord. So this transformation of the heart is a gift from the guru to the disciple. And it is invited, and we invite this from the spiritual master when we enthusiastically, so what does Prabhupada define as enthusiasm? Is to endeavor with intelligence, when we enthusiastically execute our devotional service under the instructions of the spiritual master. This is not moving from human psychology to transcendental psychology, is not a new type of therapy. It's not mental gymnastics. When we talk about fake it till you make it, what we're talking about is going deeper by pretending. It means imbibing and adopting the Vaishnava mentality. And yes, you know what? I'm going to put it out there. When we adopt the Vaishnava mentality in this world, you're going to get hurt. Okay? Because people will exploit it. Because somebody who's not imbibing, and to the degree that somebody is or isn't imbibing that actual natural psychology, that natural mentality of the jiva, if they're not imbibing that, then they are feeling threatened in themselves. So they're not going to believe it if somebody else is imbibing that. And so they will try to exploit it. And yes, we will get hurt, but we're going to get hurt anyway, even if you don't. Okay, this is a world of being cheated and betrayal. This is not me going, I'm a pretty optimistic person. You know, I'm usually thinking everything's amazing. That's you, my. So when I'm telling you that you get betrayed and, you know, cheated in this world, it's not like boohoo, I've had, you know, such a hard life of being so betrayed and cheated. I mean, look, we all have. I think everybody's had their fair share of betrayal and cheated, but it's not coming from that place. It's just a fact, you know, where you've got a group of people where everybody feels threatened and like their sense of being valued is constantly under, you know, risk. They're going to all be clambering to keep themselves secure, even if it means at the expense of others. So when we adopt a Vaishnava mindset, what we are doing is those same risks are going to continue. It's not that it puts us at more risk, okay? But we'll probably learn our lesson quicker, right? And we'll start to realize much more quickly that actually Krishna's always got our back. Guru's always got our back. And this world will always be a place of betrayal and being cheated, but that's okay, because we have an antidote. So if we're going to imbibe, as we imbibe different values of our devotional mindset, we need to do it wholeheartedly. Now, whatever we do wholeheartedly, that means really understand that what's the pain that's going to come from this and what's the pleasure that's going to come from this. When I do it wholeheartedly, I'm embracing both of those things. And when we do something wholeheartedly, the purification, the pain that comes from it is easier to tolerate and easier to learn from. Okay, it's easier to learn from. So I'm going to stop there and just really just leave you with the take-home message of this, that when we read these wonderful mindsets of these exalted souls, especially where they seem contradictory to what might be healthy to be successful in this world, or what might be healthy to not get exploited, I think it's important to remind ourselves that it is exactly as it should be. Our divine psychology is different to our human psychology. And so when we take to spiritual life, we are taking a risk by aligning the two. But in aligning the two, we don't make our life here any worse what was going to come to us is going to come to us anyway. But what we're doing is we're going to be spiritually growing. This is not to invite foolishness or lack of discrimination. We still need friends. We still need Vaishnavas to help us to navigate. This is also not to absolve anyone of, oh, that's it, I can just do whatever I want, let anyone have no boundaries, and it's all in Krishna's hands anyway. This is not an exercise in, absolving yourself of any responsibility for your actions either. It's just really this understanding that this is our natural thinking, because our natural thinking is rooted in being fully satisfied and fully loved and fully protected, where we naturally feel the compulsion to serve, feel the compulsion to serve. So I'm going to hand over to all of you for your comments, corrections, questions, anything you have. Hare Krishna Prabhu, should we give you the microphone?
I always go back to the Bhagavad Gita. This is my favorite scripture. You know? It's the one I can remember. Not a Bhagavatam and everything. It's too detailed. But also, in the Bhagavad Gita, it says here, it's chapter 4.
Mm-hmm.
And it says here, O chastiser of the enemy, the sacrifice performed in knowledge is better than mere sacrifice of natural possessions. O son of Pritha, all sacrifices of work culminate in transcendental knowledge. So, we can feel reassured that eventually... So, what do we do? Just try to learn the truth from approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. That self-realized souls, that they can impart knowledge to you, for they've seen the truth. And then... 435, finally, having obtained the real knowledge from the realized soul, I'm thinking about Prabhupada, you'll never fall again into illusion. For by this knowledge, you will see that all living beings are but part of the Supreme. Or in other words, they're mine. But this mine is where we belong to Krishna. And he belongs to us. That lovers, when they're together, they surrender to each other in this divine, in unconditional love. He belongs to me and I belong to him. It's very nice.
Very nice. Yes. Isn't that wonderful? It's this is the thing. It's in one sense, even if you look at the world around us, even where there's no interest in that transcendental mood, this one thing of I belong to you and you belong to me is the storyline for every romantic film, isn't it? Right? So somehow or another, what our real heart wants shouts very loudly, even it screams out, even in very ordinary activities. So yes, but truly, I belong to you and you belong to me eternally. It's really only something we can have with Krishna. Thank you so much for sharing those verses.
Along with Prabhupada, don't we?
Of course, we're all together.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, you moved. You're over there.
I know, I'll just move closer to the mic.
Okay.
Thanks for bringing in the psychology perspective. I've got a question about that. I was once Googling dopamine, and I discovered illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, and meaties, and all give you this dopamine hit.
So I mean, everything that you do gives you some dopamine.
So I'm just wondering, in terms of Krishna consciousness, when people give up things, they need something to replace them.
Yes.
Within the Krishna consciousness activities, how do we get our dopamine so we can stay in the process?
How do we get our dopamine fix? Right. So there's different types of dopamine fixes. So things like drugs, alcohol, sex, they give you a quick dopamine fix, right? A surge that goes up but then dissipates very quickly. But then they also give you a lot of surges of other things which are unhealthy for you as well, right? Like I meet a lot of my patients, they'll start to take drugs, or they've already been taking drugs or alcohol as a way to self-medicate, right? So they're enjoying the helpful neurochemistry that it releases, but then along with it also, because if you look at alcohol, it's actually it's a depressant. So people who use it consistently actually reduces the hormones in the brain that make you feel good, and it increases the ones that make you feel not so great, okay? So these activities, whether you look at them through the framework of medicine or whether you look at them through the framework of psychology or even the modes, those activities, there's a down with the up, right? That's mode of passion, that's mode of ignorance. In Krishna consciousness, and just even if you look at mode, so if you look at mode of goodness activities and mode of transcendence, right? Our Krishna consciousness and our sattvic activities. The way you do things, so the food you eat. So we have prasadam. That's, we cook, mode of goodness, we offer it, make it transcendental. Okay, the way we interact, the way we speak to each other, the way we dress. Every activity we do, dopamine's a neurochemical of satisfaction. We get satisfaction when we complete a task. We get a sense of achievement. So this dopamine is, it's always flowing in our brain to a lesser or greater degree. As we, even fulfilling our purpose, whatever it is in our relationships or services, that also creates a dopamine surge. But these surges, so if you look at the way dopamine responds in the brain in activities of mode of goodness and transcendence, it's slower to build, but it stays around longer. That's essentially the happiness of mode of goodness, right? It takes longer to achieve, but stays longer. So in our Krishna consciousness, look at this morning when Yadavara Prabhu was leading Kirtan, we were just dancing ecstatically. That's a dopamine increasing activity. Just dancing, even if you separate from the devotion, right? And then you have the transcendental side where the joy is coming from beyond the dopamine hit. So I think it's really important for us to realize that our human happiness doesn't always reflect our transcendental happiness. There is a happiness beyond our human psychology. When we talk about happiness, sadness, anxiety, depression, in normal colloquial formats, we're talking purely about the human state of mind. There is a happiness that comes from our supramind and our superconsciousness, which is independent of the human mind. In fact, you can be depressed and happy at the same time. The human mind can be depressed whilst an individual is transcendentally ecstatic. And we hear about this in Chaitanya Charitamrita. We have CCs full of devotees who are having ecstatic symptoms whilst their mind is in a state of lamentation, isn't it? While their human mind is in a state of lamentation. I mean, this is where the surface contradictions actually highlight just how we are not this body. Right? Because you can. I've seen it. There are Vaishnavas who they get to a certain point in their Krishna consciousness where their consciousness is so transcendental that really their body can be sick, their mind can be sick, but they're in another realm. So, yeah, the dopamine fix is just one thing. We can get a dopamine fix by doing all of our activities in the mode of goodness. And when we are in the mode of transcendence, we're getting something that's, I don't know if there's such a thing as supra dopamine, but there you go. Something that comes from a different place, which is completely independent of the brain and mind. Is that okay? Anyone else? A quick one? Anyone? Or you're all hungry for prasadam? Oh, we have one? Okay. Hare Krishna.
A small comment, but a wonderful class. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You mentioned fake it to make it.
Yes.
Is it from the Amy Cuddy book, Presence? I'm not sure if you reference that. That's the author who termed this phrase, fake it to make it. And, I'm one of the fallen souls trying to learn the ways of Krishna and fellow Vaishnavas help. So I think fake it to make it is having a humble opportunity, trying to learn the ways, helps to get that.
Just put the mic a bit closer, sorry.
So I'm trying to say that your humble opportunities when you get, and your humble trials, when you try to learn from your fellow Vaishnavas, or see at least, try to learn from them, helps to get to that stage. And when you are faking it, I think in a humble perspective, you're trying to learn. And when you go to spiritual masters, you try to make it. So, and when you learn and listen to their classes, it makes kind of like sense to your mind. And then you try to be in that present moment, which Krishna is everywhere and every time. So kind of like how dopamine helps is fake it to make it. And that's just a small comment. I don't know if it makes sense, but...
I think you're just reflecting back on when we were talking about fake it to make it. What we're saying is when faking it to making it, it's not a superficial thing. The way we in spiritual life look at fake it to make it is what we're doing is we're following the footsteps of, we're imbibing. I'm in this difficult situation. This is how my mind's telling me to deal with it. But actually, how should I deal with it in a way that is actually uplifting to my consciousness, uplifting to the other person's consciousness, and in a way that would be pleasing to Krishna? It may not please my false ego right now, but it will please him, and it will align much more with who I actually am. I might not know who I actually am yet. I may not be there, but Krishna's telling me that actually in my real self, I'm like this. So let me be like that in this world also. Then it becomes much, much easier. But yeah, it has to be rooted in sadhana. Thank you very much. Let's stop there and head for breakfast. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.